So good morning, everyone, to our second class in our series. Just to check here. You've seen my slideshow. And are you able to hear me? Thumbs up if you can hear me. Perfect. Thank you. So today we're going to be touching on Antonio Gaudí's Casa Batlló in Barcelona, Spain. It's our second lecture in our series, Five 20th Century Houses. Before we jump right into that, I just wanted to update you from last week on the Artemis mission with NASA, as we're seeing here on screen. Was supposed to launch on Saturday. It did not. They ended up scrubbing the launch, rescheduling because of a problem with a leaking hydrogen connection. You can see here in this image. Let me get my cursor going here. You can see in this image here the base of the ship, and you can and the connection here that is a quick breakaway as the ship launches off, and you can see the pipes coming through here. This is where they fuel load the hydrogen fuel for the ship, and they're having problems with this leaking, and so they postponed the launch. Hopefully that'll be happening later this week. But I also I bring back to this because of a again as we mentioned last week. The industrialization is a theme that we're going to see in this course, and the rocket ship going to the moon certainly being an example of that industrialization. But more specifically to today's lecture on Antonio Gaudí, we see here NASA struggling with trying to resolve and solve this physical problem of this leaking vent in order for safety measures and these types of things. This is one of Gaudí's strong suits that we're going to see here today in his work, which is this problem solving of physical materials and techniques. And this is actually what was referred to in his era as Capo Maestro, which is for chief master. Was the way that they would refer to him, not so much as architect as we know him today. That's more of a modern term. Back then, you would have the various trades, masons and plumbers and various things. And then the gentleman that would be leading those trades would be considered the master. So the master mason or the master plumber, for example, and the architect that would be leading all the masters in the various trades would be the chief master. Or Capo Maestro. With that also, another little point here related to NASA, which is of interest, is that we see here 50 years later from the Apollo missions that went to the moon back in the 60s, was a government-funded NASA program at the time. And now we have these private sector that's getting into the space race. And I point this out because it's of interest that this rocket here, the Artemis mission, is kind of a hybrid. It's a little bit private. It's a little bit public. And we see them struggling to get up off the ground as compared to in the private sector. SpaceX, as an example, seems to be launching ships about on average about one per every 5 days, which is a purely private company. So in any event, related to Gaudí in that regard, we see these industrialists at the turn of the century had this huge amount of wealth that they were gaining that we're going to speak to here a little bit as we go along. But this wealth was used to hire people such as Antonio Gaudí to build these buildings for them, almost as a patron relationship. And this type of funding is an example that is a little bit different than the capitalist form of construction and design that we have today. With that, I want to real quickly jump on to a poll. Just a real quick one, yes or no. And the question is there a myth a narrative or a story behind every home. So if you could weigh in on that very quickly. And it looks like we're about 75% believing that, yes, there is a myth or a narrative behind behind every home. I'm going to get into a little bit more of an explanation as we go along. Keep that a little bit of a mystery for you at the moment. But let's before we get into Gaudi, let me give a little context into Casa Batlló today. 1872 was the start of the Third Carlist War, and then in 1874, a couple years later, the fall of the First Spanish Republic, restoring the monarchy to the region in Spain. Around this time, 1885, we're looking here at what's referred to as the Dragon Gate. This was a commission of Antonio Gaudi's by Giuseppe Güell, which was also one of these industrialists in Barcelona. In fact, the most wealthiest industrialist in Barcelona at the time. He commissioned him to design a country estate out away from the city. The city was bustling with industry, noise, and smoke, and pollution, much that we're familiar with here in Pittsburgh's history. So these that could afford to would build homes out away from the city and the country to escape this type of thing. And this was one of Gaudi's first earliest commissions, this what's referred to as the Dragon Gate. We're looking here, a part of the brick that makes up this gate, and we see in the mortar joints little scraps and fragments of tile, decorative tile, pieces of tile. And these are just scraps that are coming off the tile that's being placed on site. And this is this was a form of Moorish, was a technique that the Moorish tradition in construction that would place these small shards within the ceramic mortar set between the bricks. This coming from Hispanic Arabic influence in this region that was very much part of Gaudi's work, picking up on these various types of styles. But what's interesting, and the reason I point this out in particular, was because this may have led to, you see here atop this same, this gate, this entry gate here, the Dragon Gate that we're looking at. You see in his tile work, this circular-shaped or dome cupola here that is placed. And this is a very common aesthetic that we're going to see here also today in multiples. But it presents a problem when you tile the surface, because with the top that comes to a point, the surface gets smaller and smaller, and so the inlays of these tiles would have to be arranged in such a way that the tiles would almost have to be custom made to fit to it. And Gaudi had this innovative method here, and this was the first use of it, this broken mosaic, these broken pieces he would lay in and fill them in. So you see the green pattern here are full tiles, and then he would leave these kind of open spaces as it gets smaller and smaller, filling that in with these broken pieces, just as a means to cover the surface, not only in a much less expensive form of tile, but also even just the labor could also theoretically be laid with a less experienced tile setter as compared to the more intricate mosaic inlays. That was a very costly trade. You're seeing a few more examples of these broken tiles that are set in here. And this is a theme that we're going to see going forward throughout his work. Another theme, if we look a little bit closer at the Dragon Gate itself, is the is the ironwork. If you look closely, you see the use of various elements like these industrial springs, chains, clips, and all of these things kind of incorporated almost as a collage, a piece of sculpture that we would refer to today as this assemblage that you can see here. But in particular, what's significant is the pieces that he's assembling or he's bringing together, these steel meshes, springs, are all industrial materials, industrial pieces that are being fabricated by these factories at the turn of the century. So here he's taken this readily available machined parts and he's reassembling them into a sculptural piece. Again, the materials and the methods are very modern in the fact that they are responding to this industrial time. But at the same time, he's using his tradesmen, his sculptors, metal workers to assemble these in such a way that is also referring to the arts, this tradition that we saw last week in Peter Behrens' house, where he has this reference to the arts and crafts. This is very much still in Gaudi's mind of the same period. And he's trying to bridge this gap between these two. We see it here reflected in the Dragon Gate. This brings us to the 1890s, which was the start of the what's referred to as the Modernismo movement, or the modern movement through Catalonia or in Spain. And this is an example here of a house, early house, one of the first houses of Gaudi's, Casa Vicens. And I point this out just to show you an example of what he was doing prior to what we're going to look at in Casa Batlló. You can see, again, the house exterior is covered in tiles, very ornate, colorful, bright tiles, patterned in contrast to each other. But also, significantly, you see the layering of materials. You see the layering of the flat tile surfaces, the textured surfaces. Even the over here, you can see these insets where you see exposed stonework. The structure of the house is being exposed here, something that was not done at the time. Typically, finishes, plaster or tile would cover over the structure. Here, he's leaving it exposed and raw. It's a certain amount of truth to the material, letting you know how the house is being held up. But also, at the same time, you see over here on the left-hand side, closer to the roof of the building, top of the wall, you can see how he's cantilevering out, projecting these bricks out as he works his way up, corbelling them to create a much heavier mass at the top surface that almost seems suspended in the air from below. A similar effect here with the balconies that are coming out, projecting out. You can see the brackets underneath of the brickwork that support that from below. But at the same time, he's trying to create this dynamic feel to the structure where the weight and the mass of the material almost becomes weightless as it's hovering up above, almost in defiance of gravity. And this kind of upward movement is also a theme that we're going to see going forward in his work as well. Here we see in 1892, just a couple years after Casa Vicens, we get into his 10-year-long study, and this is also another point that I wanted to give some context to in Gaudi. There's three periods in his career where he gets into a decade-long study in particular, and we're going to go through all three of these here before we get into Casa Batlló. The first one being this study of natural forms, and this was... this was in 1892 that he took this on, and this ran up and through 1900. And in particular, this is the facade, the nativity facade of Sagrada Familia, which was a commission for a large cathedral that he was given very early on. And this cathedral was created, founded as the Church for the Holy Family. It was dedicated to Barcelona's patron saint, Saint Joseph, but it was primarily intended almost as a protest against this industrialization that we're talking about here today, where they were sidelining Catalan culture by the Spanish monarchy. And so out on the outskirts of town, in a farm community, which was the place where they could get land, still relatively inexpensive, this cathedral was built and became known as the Cathedral of the Poor in this regard, reflecting a cathedral to be built. If you crawl back from our theme last week, where this church was being provided for this lower class of people coming from the rural countryside to move into the city to take on these jobs within these factories in this industrial explosion. And so this working class that was growing in numbers, as well as in acquiring a little bit more wealth than they had previously, this church was being brought up to serve this new class. Let me read a quote here by Gaudi. He said, "Architecture is the first of the plastic arts, sculpture and painting depending on it. An architect is a man of synthesis who has a vision of plasticity, which is an overall vision, and who places objects in relation to each other and in distance to each other, and he groups them together rather than dispersing them. He generalizes and sees what exists and what does not exist." And so here we see on the facade here of Sagrada Familia, this idea of plasticity that he's referring to, that he's trying to pick up in the surface texture of this stone relief that we have carved into the side, as well as the figures, these human figures that he's also depicting stories from the Bible in this on the surface of this nativity entrance to the cathedral. And it's these figures, which is the forms, this natural form of study that we're looking at here. In particular, he says that sight is the sense of plasticity, the sculptural dimension, so to speak, of space, light, and immensity. So in Gaudi's mind, it was this search for this truly organic ornament that he was turning to, this Catalan tendency to be straightforward or strict or hyper-realistic is another trait of these Catalan people. And so he derived from this observation of nature, or in this case, these observation of people, looking at people as a form of nature, as a natural kind of grammar to base the form for these figures that he was creating on the facade. Gaudi asserted that art is beauty, and beauty is the glow of truth, without which it would not exist. To possess truth, one must study things in depth. As for beauty, it is life, which is manifest in the human form through movement. So this idea of movement, of gesture, that he's trying to create in these scenes and these depicting of these people, he's trying to create, make these figures almost come to life, not static, sculptural stone figures, but ones that seem to be in movement, in action, or in gesture. And so how did he do this? He had sculptors of his time would use plaster quite frequently to make casts and molds of figures. But they quite often would not admit to this publicly because they didn't want to take away from their reputation as being sculptors that could carve in stone. But once Gaudi had learned or discovered through his studies that the Greeks used to use plaster frequently, he felt like it was a justifiable material. And so he embraced this plaster and created molds of his figures, cast directly from individuals that he would get to sit for him. We see a woman here on the right playing a harp, and he would take molds and cast directly from these individuals in order to then, from these molds that he would cast, he would be able to create these figures in his own mind and work through those designs. And then once he had them to a point where he felt that it was complete, he would pass these plaster casts off to his sculptors, his stonemasons, for them to make carvings to replicate the plaster that he had created. And so it was almost kind of a shorthand for him, or a material that he would use to study the figure with. And interestingly enough, these figures were people, again, it was this working class group of people from the community that were going to be attending this church that he took this. And it was a way of him trying to immortalize these individuals on the side of his cathedral for all of time. We see here another example of a figure that's being used that results in Mary with her infant child. So again, in Gaudi's mind, truth of life was a reflection of eternal beauty. And by doing these plaster casts, it avoided this so-called expressiveness that was often found in the sculptor's work. When they would carve these stones, they would embellish the figures to try to make them more attractive. He felt it was of more interest to take the gestures and the expressions directly from the figure in a cast. And that was more authentic, more true to nature. And then by extension, this was what he referred to as eternal beauty. I'll show here a photograph also of interest. This was his one of his chief stonemasons, one of the sculptors that worked for him. Matamala was his name. But I point this out because this was a technique that he used. You can see this is a photograph. But he had set up some mirrors behind and around the person that would be sitting for him, and so that he could take one photograph, and within one photograph he could capture all sides of the figure. Again, it was a shorthand, or photography was this new medium that was coming online at this time period, and he saw this new technology as a form of a tool that he could utilize to help within his practice. And so this photography was a way for him to document and record these figures during these sittings, so that he could go back and refer to the photographs later as he's working on his pieces once the person had left. Around this time, 1893, as he's doing these studies, natural studies in plaster, one of his close friends, a mentor of his, Bishop Grau, had passed away. As you can imagine, this was quite devastating to him. In addition to this, the same year, there were some bombings that were occurring by these anarchists that were in Barcelona, reacting or rebelling against this monarchy, or this aristocratic rule that they did not agree with. And all of these things kind of really played on Gaudi, and to the point where the following year, in 1894, he went on a Lent fast where he stopped eating during the period of Lent. And this lasted for months, to the point where he became so weak and frail that he was bedridden. He was there for weeks on end as well, to where he became almost just skin and bones, almost corpse-like. And it was during this time that he reflected on his condition, and he looked beyond this natural form that he was studying in plaster towards what's beneath the surface of the skin, what's holding the frame and the body together, these bones that he could see on his own body. In this condition where he was on this Lenten fast. And so this, as you can imagine, resulted in him getting interested in studying the skeletal figure Here we see the same technique of the photograph being used on these skeletons. And as a side note, interestingly enough, these are actual skeletons. They're not replicas that we would be familiar with, that the doctors use today in study of anatomy. His sculptor that we just saw in the last picture had some friends that were at the local hospital that was able to obtain for him actual skeletons of deceased individuals. For him to use, not only the sculptor would use in his own studies, but also acquire them for Gaudi, that would use them, in his studies as well of the figures we're seeing here. Interestingly enough, also a little, another side note, that Gaudi, this fast that he went on, trying to redeem, some of these, wrongdoings or that he felt, this stroke of bad luck that he was upon, was only talked out of by one of his close friends, the sculptor, out of stopping his fast because they realized that this could lead to his death by the fact that he was gaining so much attention of the fact that he was fasting for so long and that he was bedridden, his sculptor friend convinced him that this was a form of vanity. That was drawing so much attention to himself by his fasting. And so it was only with this idea of vanity, which is also seen as a sin, that he was willing to give up his fast and eat again, and bring his strength back. So with this, interest in studying the human form and bones and by extension, the bones being the structure of the human body, how the body stands up physically, this led to his second study in 1898 that ran for also about a decade. And this study of equilibrium structures in their structural sense, how they're constructed. And we're seeing here an example of this small chapel that he was building. It was a commission by his patron, Guel. And this was... you can see here the reference to the columns, very bone-like, the ribs being exposed on the underside of the ceiling or in the floor above, almost in rib fashion. And then also even the off to the side here where the holy water is placed at the entry, you can see the ironwork also held out here almost like hands, fingers, the bones of a hand that's holding this giant shell, but in such a way that the shell almost loses its solid nature and becomes almost the appearance of a fabric that's draping between these fingers that are holding it up. And this is also something we're going to see going forward, this play that he does on form and material, to where he's taking away the rigid aspect of the material and rendering it in a soft, almost visual appeal, just by the nature of the design and the relationship of the way he's presenting it in this allegorical way of a hand or a figure that's supporting this drooping. So this study that he took on, he did it in a very innovative way. We're seeing it here, this what's referred to as the asteriostatic model. And this was an innovation that he came up with, where he hung from the ceiling these lines placing small little weights at each point. And by doing this, he studied the form of the cathedral in an inverted fashion. He would take, if you see here on the left-hand side, you can see these lines all drooping down and hanging with the weights on them, and that would create a shape as they're hanging there. But then if you would take a photograph of that using the camera again, and then inverting the photograph right side up, you could then determine the shape of your forms in a parabolic arch form for the structure of the church. And this was a very interesting technique, because if we take a look at one of these pillars that supports the church. You can see these two forms here. You can see in blue this force that's coming from the rib here in the ceiling that's working down at this angle. And you can see in red another load that's coming from above, above the column. And the two are coming together at this angle. And by transferring these off to the side here, taking the red off to the side, the blue off to the side, and then connecting the two together with this purple from the from end to end, or tail to tail, they referred to, that angle of this purple that would fill in would end up becoming the angle of what this pillar needs to be in order to react to these two loads that are coming in at their at this particular angle. And this is a form of what's called graphic statics. This was done frequently at this time as a form of calculation on paper to design the loading that would be coming in from structures. But what was significant with the asteriostatic model was the fact that this was a way with the strings and the weights to be able to design a three-dimensional form with multiple loads coming on them from different directions, to where he could then create a space that was much more dynamic in shape and in relationship, and create these asymmetries that previously weren't possible with this graphic static method. And so also, again, we see a close-up detail here. You can see the structure exposed in the concrete, the mortar that's filling in between the brickwork, as well as the tile work in the ceiling. All of this stuff calculated by this this asteriostatic model as a form of calculation. And really the fascinating part of this was that with this model, we see it here in hanging with gravity again. It's utilizing gravity as a tool to where any kind of adjustment that he makes in the design of this would affect the strings that are tied to that position that he's adjusting, and by those strings that would react and reposition themselves by an adjustment that he might make would carry them through all the entire model instantly, almost like a calculating machine, to where each individual part is related to the whole, and vice versa, the entire whole is informing each individual part or connection. And so again, taking this and inverting it right side up is how he came up with the design of the form that we're seeing here above, right side up. Also, I'll show you very quickly here a photograph, again, of this model. Once he would work the design through to where he was happy with it, he would take a photograph of it, and then on the photograph, he would draw on top of it and sketch in the details in more articulation of how the interior would be built out. And so it was this combination of the asteriostatic model, the photographs, the painting on the photographs, all used as tools in ways for him to study form and to create this this church. This brings us to 1900, just a few years before Casaballo. And here we're seeing Casa Calvet, which is a commission that he received. And just for reference, this is 1900. This is the same period that we looked at last year with Peter Brenz's house in 1900, 1901. So up in Germany, Peter Brenz was working away at this artist community that we discussed last week. Here we see Gaudi down in Barcelona, Spain, working on this this commission for this industrialist. And at this time, these industrialists that previously were building these factories and textile mills, capitalizing on this industrialization that is happening, in 1898, the Spanish-American War broke out. And as a result of that, the Spaniards lost control of their colonies, some of which in the Caribbean that we're familiar with, Cuba, Puerto Rico, Guam, the Philippines, all of these were under the control of the Spaniards at the time. And they were using these colonies for cheap labor to create, go out and mine materials, as well as in the textile industry, using them for creating these fabrics and importing them into Barcelona. And by losing these colonies during the war, these industrials had to shift their money. And so they shifted to real estate. And so in this case, we have these industrialists around town that are starting to build residential units around town for, again, this growing population, Barcelona growing in size quite rapidly at this time. And so here we have Casa Calvet, who was an associate of one of Güell's, his patron, recommended him on this commission. And we see here, I'll just point this out briefly, we see this pediment at the top here, very Baroque in style. But this was against what was permitted at the time as far as a height restriction. There was the height of the building was only permitted to the top of this level here. Gaudi went beyond that to try to accentuate his building, draw prominence to his building, to his neighbors. And despite the fact that he went against the municipal limit, a year later, the town actually awarded this building as the best urban building award that they gave out annually. So by extension, rewarding some of his rebellion. Gaudi took this as a cue and really kind of fed off of it going forward in his work. We see here, taking a little bit closer look at these balconies that are protruding on the surface, we can see some sculptural work here referencing mushrooms. The owner of the building very much liked to collect mushrooms. That was a popular in the day. We see on the interior side some of the door hardware on the interiors. I point this out because this was created by taking wet plaster and sticking his fingers in it and then making these shapes, as well as down here, just working in with this wet plaster material. From his studies he did previously, he was getting pretty familiar with plaster as a medium. And by doing so, he was now using it as a way to create these irregular shapes that then once the plaster would set up and harden, he could use them to cast, as we're seeing here in metal, for the hardware on the doors. Also, if we look at the chairs within this building, Casa Calvet, we see these wood-form chairs. And again, I point these out. If you look at the legs on the back, you can see the way that he's handling these, the shapes of these, the knobs and the ends of them, very much have this anatomic skeletal form that he was very much interested in his work at the time period, in the seats themselves. And I also point this out in contrast to the Casa Batlló chair we'll be looking at here very shortly, just in reference to his different handling of the medium from this period here in 1900 to Casa Batlló coming here in just about 5 years. this brings us to 1902. This is a gate that was initially created as an entryway to an artist friend of his, a painter. And we see here his stylization that we just saw in Casa Calvet, this Baroque kind of treatment of the pediment at the top of the building has now really become a freeform line, completely loosened up from a symmetrical drafted line by instrument to a line that's created by the free hand, almost a sketch. And we see this looseness that's now coming into his work. He's taking much more liberty with, as we mentioned, having some success with Casa Calvet, getting recognition with the award. And so now taking that liberty and running with it. A year later, 1903, we come to Park Güell, another commission by his patron, Giuseppe Güell. These are the viaducts. And as I was mentioning before with his stereostatic model, here we see this what's referred to as this graphic statics. This is these paper calculations that they would do previously, each one of these lines and arrows being a force that's being directed, and the arrow length referencing the amount of load or force that's being applied. And here we see him applying this to the design of these viaducts. But in specifically, let me read a quote here by Gaudi where he says, when masons would build a wall, they placed two plumb bobs uprights and a string and a line between them horizontally. And if one of the uprights goes out of plumb, which happens much more often than you may think, the masons who are believing that they are building a flat wall are in fact making a parabola. We have gone directly and deliberately to this form and seen its beauty and the possibilities that it offers. We have also used it for our vaults. And so here we see these uprights. Again, they're inclined like we saw in the earlier church that came as a result of his studies with the stereostatic model. Here he's doing it intentionally. Again, taking the inclination of these columns that are supporting this vault, and then the vault itself also making an asymmetric vault, no longer in a more classic geometric form, rolling this down here into the side of the hillside that it's retaining through this viaduct. In the same park, this is the gatehouse, the roof of the gatehouse to the entry of the park. And we've seen here these forms, he's taking even greater liberties. You can see this parabolic shape that he was discussing in his quote on the rooftop, also irregular in shape, asymmetric. But we also see, if you look closely, you can see the broken tiles, the mosaics that we've been seeing in his earlier work, used to ornament and decorate the surface, but at the same time, also a means to do so in a very efficient and economical manner. At the same time, he's even bringing in materials that are castaways. Here we're seeing some pottery from broken pieces of tableware that he's implementing into the surface as a form of decoration and adding some texture and relief to the surface. We see the gatehouse as a whole here. Another technique that he used in this in particular was that he distorted the gatehouse in scale. You can see this figure down here. And by enlarging the openings, the windows, the doors, but making and exaggerating the roof as well, but in relationship to a much shorter height in the wall, he's creating this almost kind of like a hallucinatory wonderland type effect where you have this building that normally would be of a certain scale, much smaller, to create almost like a fairy tale type setting, which is in reference to the storyline Hansel and Gretel, which this particular piece is in reference to, having an analogy with that. This brings us to 1904, getting very close here to Casa Batlló. And this is where he begins this third phase of study, decade-long study, this time in color and light. This is at the Mallorca Cathedral. And this is, and read a quote here by Gaudi as well. It says, architecture is the main plastic art. All of its excellence comes from light. Architecture is the organization of light. Sculpture is the play of light. Painting is the reproduction of light through color, which is the decomposition of light. The light in a church must be sufficient and no more, for a church is a place of withdrawal. And so here we see the church itself is not a building that he had created. He was to restore this church to its former glory. It had had accrued much work over the centuries, and he was commissioned to try to bring back the church to its original design, its original intent. Part of this restoration in his mind was, as he see in this quote, the study of light and color. And so he brings in over the altar, he brings in natural light through candles, where he says the altar should be lit by candles. This being candlelight, being with the flame in motion, creates a flickering of light, a movement of light to create the space inside, give it a form of life as a result of the light dancing around. Again, this idea of trying to create a living architecture where the space comes to life or feels that it's alive and breathing. Color was an obsession for Gaudi, and he would say that when he conceived of a building, he could already see the colors of the building. When people see a pale person, he would say, they say that he looks like a walking corpse. On the other hand, when they see a corpse that still has color, they will say it seems that the person is still alive. And the fact is that all living beings have color. Color is inherent in life, and life is the essential quality of a work of art. And so here we're seeing one of the techniques that he used in this restoration, the stained glass window here beyond. He came up with this technique of layering the glass on top of each other. He would use four colors of glass, yellow, red, blue, and white. And this glass would be toned down. This normal form of stained glass would be toned down with an acid to lighten the tones. You can see here in the red, you can see a darker red and lighter red to create gradations. But then also by overlaying these colors together, for example, when he would mix colors, yellow and blue to create a green, this type of mixture of light where he would overlay them rather than applying an enamel paint, which was the practice at the time for stained glass, would allow the light to still come through the glass just by layering the glass, whereas the enameling to create a green, for example, would be darkening the glass with the enamel, so it would be choking the light out. And so he had developed this technique of layering the glass to allow the light to still come through bright and radiant, but also able to control the colors by these combinations of these three primary colors layered together. Quite innovative. This brings us to 1906, which was the year that Casa Batlló was complete. In that time period, he moved to Park Güell, into a house that he had designed in Park Güell with his father and his niece. His father was in poor health, and so he moved him into this house to try to help him. But despite this, that same year, his father passed away. And this was in Gaudi's mind, or in his own words, what he referred to as the year of his Holocausto. It was a very dark year for him. The same time period, there was also this movement that was coming along in architecture, Neo-centrism, which was a return to the classics or the classical form of architecture. And this went against this modern form that Gaudi was a proponent of. And so things in 1906 did not seem to be going his way. This was followed up in 1909, a few years later, by this photograph we're seeing here, referred to as the Cementa Tragica, which was a couple week period where the locals rebelled and they torched and burned and vandalized many of the churches through town. This was, again, a blow to Gaudi, being a very deeply religious man. 1914, his right-hand man, he referred to as his right-hand man, his assistant, passed away, that was doing most of his work for him at the time as far as drafting. This left Gaudi pretty much working alone at this point, late in his life in 1914. And on top of that, the Sagrada Familia, the cathedral that was his life's work, that he was awarded at a very young age and continued to keep him employed through his years. All these other projects that we're looking at were in tandem to this cathedral that he worked on. The Sagrada in 1914 found itself in great debt, a large part as a result of the fact that World War I was breaking out. And so the church was actually looking to terminate the construction that it was that was underway. And Gaudi, with all these blows that he was receiving these last couple years, couldn't stomach this. And so he decides to sell his family farm to raise some money to pay for the debts for the church, to keep the project going. And at this point, 1914, he dedicates the rest of his life to the completion of this church. And so we see here some images of his studio. On the left-hand side, you can see some of these plaster models. And on the right-hand side, you can see the church in its state in 1914. You can see on the right side is we're seeing from the interior of the church as if we were standing inside the church, the backside of the nativity facade that we were looking at earlier. And you can see the far right here, this the bell tower, the only bell tower that was built at the time that was flanking the nativity facade, the nativity entry. And we see in his studio these plaster cast models of him studying the design and the form for these bell towers. He's working this out in his studio. We also see of interest here on the left-hand side, take a look at this form here. This is a plaster cast of the balcony that we're going to see of Casa Batlló here just momentarily. And so here's the nativity facade. Once all four of the bell towers went up, you could see this with the nativity facade here that he had been working on earlier. And at the top of these bell towers, he created these ventilators that Gaudi became known for in all of his commissions. These pieces that would project up on top of the roofs, almost capping the roof in decoration. But in this case, it was this form not only of decoration, but also of a spiritual nature, where the spires are reaching up into the heavens. Up into the realm of God. And so we see here on the very tops, again, the mosaics. In this case, it's broken as well, but it's made of Venetian glass, imported from Venice, the best glass that you get in the region. And so it was brought in, sparing no expense here, despite the fact that it's a broken mosaic that we saw in the very early commission of the, if you recall back here, the Dragon Gate, where the ceramics that he was using broken were just picked up off the ground, and it was basically the throwaway shards. Here he's custom ordering this Venetian glass because it's at the top of this cathedral at the apex, the most prominent, important point. And so we see this going from in the beginning of his career to where this technique of these mosaics is something that he developed, became known for as a signature at the end of his life here, becomes really his crowning achievement on the pinnacles of the cathedral. As he said, reaching up into the sky, a quote, he says, "Look at that spire. Isn't it true that it looks as if it's connecting heaven with earth? This burst of mosaic is the first thing sailors will see as they approach Barcelona. It will give them a radiant welcome." And then finally, one last photograph here. This is the church as it stood in 1926 when he passed away. He spent from 1914, where he mentioned, building this first spire here on the right. You can see the other three still under construction, but he was able to top off the top of it 1 year before he passed away to see its completion. And this was taken the year that he died to record kind of the progress of the cathedral that he spent his life working on. And so with that, I'm going to take just a 5-minute break And we'll return here at 11:03. We'll pick up with Casa Batlló after the break. So welcome back. Just a minute here. Yes. Yes. I don't recall off the top of my head. I'd have to get back to you on that one. It's in reference to a prayer, but I'm drawing a blank at the moment. Good question, though. Thank you. So, Casa Batlló that we're seeing here on this street, right-hand side, the building here on the right-hand side, this street was referred to as the Block of Discord. It was on Barcelona's most elegant boulevard, and at this time in 1904, during this commission that he received, this particular stretch of the boulevard, this one particular block on the odd numbered side of the street that we're seeing here, was being built up by the big names in town, the architects that were known in 1898 and completed in 1900. This building right here is Casa Matier. And this was done by a gentleman by the name of Puig. And he was commissioned to create, again, this residential unit that was that these industrialists were converting to their monies. In this rare form, you see this pediment, triangular-shaped pediment, was a rare shape in Barcelona. You don't find, and this was in some regards, it was in reference to the letter A for the gentleman that commissioned the work, Amater, and as well as also the almond tree, which is his name is in reference to. Over on the left-hand side here in the far corner in 1902 began construction on a work. This was just a couple years before Gaudi's Casa Batlló that we're seeing here on the right. This building on the left corner was completed in 1905, just a year before Gaudi's work. And this was Casa Yeo Morero. And this was, again, by another leading architect in town. This particular architect, Dom Michi, and he was probably Gaudi's greatest not so much a rival, but he was very well known. And we see in that work here, we'll go into a little bit here in the two of them. Here's the first one, an interior from the street or inside looking out onto the street. We see a column down here through the center of the window. Very decorative, very traditional in form, Baroque. Just point this out just as in reference, so when we take a look at Gaudi's work, you can see the contrast. On the building on the corner, this building actually, this photograph that's taken here, some of this is not the original design. It was restored mid-century, but what did was in the original design in 1905 completion was the cupola up on the top corner. And if we take a little bit closer look to the top, you can see the mosaic, again, Gaudi's technique, the mosaic being laid into it, but it's they're traditional mosaics. They're not broken shards, so they're laid out. This being a much more costly form of tile setting, where each one of these tiles has to be made specifically for a particular place and location to create these patterns that you were seeing here, as well as also a very high skilled laborer to set these in place in this fashion. Seeing also again the interior on this corner unit, looking out, you can see the tree motif in the glasswork. Again, also very skilled glass work that's being done here. This is a tree in reference to the mulberry tree, which is again also the that where the name of the gentleman that commissioned the work, his family's name derives. And this points out, if we recall back from last week's lecture with Peter Behrens, where this idea of a complete work, where all of the elements in the design come together to create this space. This is what we're seeing here with the glass work, with the all the moldings, the trim work on the exterior, the tile work, all pulled together in this idea of complete work, which was something that was a signature of this architect as well, that we see also in Gaudi. This was a very kind of modern concept that was coming online that we saw last week in Germany. Here we see it this week in Barcelona. So with Casa Batlló, he was commissioned by a again another industrialist in the textile industry, a friend of his patron Giuseppe Goel. Josef Batlló was his name, and in 1903 he purchased the building that Gaudi is going to restore. It was an existing building, actually, ironically, that was built by one of Gaudi's teachers, professors that he had in school. In 1877, the building was completed. Here, just a few decades later, Gaudi is going to renovate it. In the owner's words, he said that the building had no charm that he had purchased, and he asked Gaudi to use his imagination to create a fairy tale house. So Gaudi turned to his to Batlló's children, which he had a few of, we're seeing this in illustration here, and asked them what type of fairy tale they would like to see the house built in. One of the children said they wanted to see a sea. We're seeing here, let me get my laser pointer, seeing their imagination, seeing they wanted the Mediterranean Sea. Another one had said that they wanted a carnival type house. A third one said they wanted a hero, a legend, so to speak. And so Mr. Batlló was a little embarrassed and said, no, that's too much. And Gaudi said, not a problem, we'll do them all. And so this was, again, one of Gaudi's really his strengths was the fact that he could kind of layer, much like we saw with the glass work when he was working on the light in the restoration of the cathedral just before the break, layering the glass to create these lights, or layering the brick we saw very early on with Casa Vicens. This idea of layering these materials, these ideas of the children to create a finished work was his really his strength and his talent. So we see here the front elevation of Casa Batlló, on the right, and we see also his pier, the building on the left that was in place when he came to work on his work. And we see an early sketch drawing for this design. And I just wanted to point out a couple things here. We see in the sketch, you can see the figure initially was very symmetrical, three peaks with the center peak very tall. And then he, with a heavier line, he drew over this, and he ended up raising the peak on the right side a little bit higher than he initially had drawn, where it was symmetrical with the left. And then he also lowered the peak on the left-hand side to create an asymmetry to the roof line. He then also carried that line asymmetry here we see in the cornice of the building. Again, a free-forming line, much like the gate that we saw earlier before the break, bringing this freehand element in. And you can see then the result of that on the actual building here of the cornice, as well as the roof line becoming even more so irregular as it developed from the sketch. This also, I'll point out of interest, because his fellow colleague here that was well known within the city, his senior, actually, as far as age, he wanted to show a little bit of reverence and didn't want to kind of take his design, which was much more adventurous, right up to his building. It exceeded it in height, One of the things that he did with the building, you see the openings here on the front, was the existing building, but he ended up adding an additional floor to the top to extend the roof up even higher, taking it more prominence to his neighbor. But at the same time, he dropped this side down, as we saw in the sketch, to lower it, and even the molding here, he dropped down and terminated it below this triangular pediment to kind of create a little bit of a friendliness to his neighbor visually and aesthetically to not offend as much. And so by doing so, this vertical element, which is the spire, he pulls it in. Here he had it in the sketch on center. He pulls it off center, but he also holds it back to create this little bit of a balcony here to soften the edge. And in elevation here, it's not so apparent, but from the street, you can see it a little bit more visually here. You can see the effect of him pulling this balcony back from the face and also lowering it down. It creates a little bit of softer edge as it terminates here, as I mentioned before, with the molding to the pediment here on the right. This also, rooftop here, became a metaphor for Mount Sararat, which was a well-known mountain range in Barcelona that surrounds Barcelona, which is almost a place of homage, a church being located up there, a very well-known. And this this rooftop becomes, in Gaudi's mind, a metaphor for this mount, with its peaked up and capped with the spire and the cross on top. Interestingly enough, you can see the cross here on top, that the this is what's referred to as Gaudi's four-armed cross, where it's a cross in three dimension as opposed to just two-dimensional cross. So it's a sculptural cross in space as opposed to a flat two-armed cross that you would find on a surface. So here he again is sculpturally taking this into space to create a piece of sculptural work. And when this cross arrived on site from the factory where the ceramic was poured, it arrived, the ceramic was damaged, and many of his masons that were working on it at the time were disappointed and thought that they'd have to send it back and have it remade. But Gaudi said no. Familiar with these broken mosaics, he said it will work just fine, and they installed it in the broken form here that we're seeing. Down at the street level, we see the columns that are supporting the facade that are rendered in such a way, almost like waves lapping up on the shore. Again, referencing the Mediterranean Sea that one of the children wanted to see in the elevation. So from the street level, as you look up, it almost looks like these waves in rhythmic form, as well as also the surface treatment, almost becoming shells on the seashore. Also, in allegory, the rooftop from this particular angle almost becomes the back of a dragon. In this mythic hero that the child was looking for, the hero is slaying the dragon that we see here with his lance that's placed down into the back of the dragon, and so we see the back the dragon here laying atop this mountain of bones, so to speak, of these masks. The balconies become these masks of these knights that the dragon has slayed, and so the hero comes out and slays the dragon. And also the opening here in the roof, you can see again this kind of the eyes of the dragon here, and the cornice with the teeth, quite playful. And if we take a little bit closer look at the balconies here, we can see the original design in his sketch was very Baroque, very symmetric in metalwork, Here we've seen him being a little bit more plastic and playful in the form. If you recall back before the break in his studio, the plastic form in his that he was working that detail out. We could also interpret this as a carnival mask for the third request from the children, with the tile work on the surface being this confetti for a Venetian carnival. And if from the street, as you look up, he took the time to create an undulation in the surface. So that way the tile, which was made of, again, Venetian glass, could be laid in such a way that the surface of the tile would not be flat. And so you would almost have the tile at different angles on the surface of the wall. So that way, as the sunlight would hit it at different angles, it would cause the tile to glimmer and shimmer in different patterns. He also, at this point in particular, we're seeing again the same broken mosaic that we see in his other work. But in this particular case, he's creating much more space between the shards. And here he's exploring this idea of the gap or the space between the element, calling attention to the mortar between it. Some more treatment here of the or closer look here at the tiles on the roof. These tiles were enameled to get their color. You could see in the opening here, the tiles, I'll point this out as of interest, is that the tiles are all uniform in shape. Again, speaking to the kind of the machined process of manufacturing these pieces. But when he gets to the opening that's irregular, again, much his same technique that he used with the Dragon Gate, he fills them in with the broken mosaics. So he's still using the same techniques that we see very early on. That also happens along the edge where he's filling in where these more regular pieces come to the irregular line that he's created on the surface. Of interest, if we look closer at the windows on the exterior, you can see his columns, and the columns very bone-like. The house was referred to as the House of Bones because of this, and so we see, you know, his fascination with the skeleton in the bones and the form, but in particular at the joints of the bones, he's got this flower floral pattern that's springing forth from it. So it's almost this. This metaphor that he's saying, from death comes life, and kind of like this restoration or return to where he is, again, creating a metaphor on the surface of in the same way that he's restoring this building. He's also trying to restore the people that are occupying the building as well as the city at large. This idea of trying to make up amends for these sins that are happening with these rebellions and these various things that he's reacting to. If we go onto the interior of these same windows, we see these columns being handled in a slightly different fashion, a little bit more conservative, but at the same time we see the movement and the irregularity brought in onto the swirl of the ceiling. Again, yes. It's a renovation of an existing structure. It was actually designed by one of his former professors about three decades prior to his renovation. So he's applying this surface to the facade, this new surface to an existing building. He's also adding to the top floor, the attic that will be seen here shortly, as well as also some interior renovations. And we see here the same kind of handling on the exterior form of this these irregular forms and shapes. This is all being done here in stone by his stonemasons, bringing them together at the joints that you see here in these pieces. The same type handling that he's doing on the interior, this organic shape and treatment of the plaster work on the ceiling here. We also see some patterns, again, that kind of reference to his mosaics, broken mosaics in the painterly on the interior. We can see is how the plaster ceiling works into the woodwork, the doors that frame the space. Also very irregular in shape, the glass work, the glazing that's with inside those door frames. Picking up on some of the glass and the techniques that we saw before the break in his restoration of the cathedral. If we go into the floor plan here, we see this is the room that we were just looking at. You can see the swirl pattern on the ceiling here and in the window that faces the front boulevard, the irregular shape here. This is the elevation that he creates on the surface of the existing building. On the interior, you can see the irregular line that's being carried through in the walls. This is all interior renovations that he's doing to create an organic form within each of these spaces as he works through this through the building. And so from the entry hall here, the set of stairs that leads to the ground or the main floor, which is owned by the Batlló family. The four upper floors above that are rented out. And so this is the main staircase that goes to the master of the building. And you can see, again, this analogy to the dragon in the way that he's handling the wood, almost like a spine that's kind of wrapping up along the staircase here and slithering into this gap in the ceiling being handled very organically, with the line as well as the form. Couple closer details here of some of that treatment, and it's not just the plaster work, but also all of the carvings in the wood. Again, also creating this formwork, and this formwork is significant because what he's doing, much like we saw with before the break, in his handling of the chair, if you recall back, that had this very anatomical form. He's doing a similar thing with all of the materials here within Casa Batlló. It's what's kind of referred to as this softening of the material to where the material almost becomes liquid. It feels like it's still wet, if you can imagine. And this is going back to his experience with plaster work, kind of working with this wet material. And here we see in the door of each of the suites, you can almost see that he's creating these bones that are almost coming to the surface of this liquid door. Even the hardware, the pulls, very much similar to what we saw in Casa Calvet, where he's creating them by the pinch of the fingers, almost in a plaster form. And this brings us to the chair that's used here in Casa Batlló. And this is, if you recall, to the chair in Casa Calvet with the legs and the arms very much looking as if they're bone anatomical figures. Here he's taken it to where he's stripped away any kind of materiality to the chair itself. And it's rendering it almost like a plastic clay or plaster type material to where it's a soft material that when you sit down in the chair, it depresses from the weight of the body. When you pick the chair up here by the corners, it almost makes thumbprints in the corners from picking it up, and even more so the legs from the weight of the body sitting. The legs are almost buckling from the weight. And so he's creating this gesture within the chair that's responding to not only the action of the figure that's sitting or picking the chair up, but more importantly, he's rendering the chair in a different material, this plastic soft clay-like material that strips away all of the properties of wood, being a rigid, solid form that we're familiar with. And so he's creating this more plastic, modern material And this is significant going forward, as we'll see in subsequent lectures, is this idea of plasticity that he speaks about. Here's another chair at the entryway, a small little nook, kind of to receive guests in the form of a mushroom. Again, another popular theme. And then also another thing I'll point out here at the front window is these down here at the bottom are these ventilation pieces. So even though he's doing all these gymnastics with form and aesthetic, he's also dealing with the practical side, the functional side of the space, much like we saw with Peter Brenz last week, this kind of balance of architecture between beauty and function. Gaudi is handling it the same way. This ventilation is to handle the air coming in and out, to get fresh air into the building. And specifically, this is really one of the brilliant parts of Casa Batlló, is the central staircase we're seeing here in section. This is the main floor that we've just been looking at, and the upper floors of the other suites. And down through the center, he opens up this stair shaft to not only bring light down into the center of the building that he can then pierce into through these skylights into the suites from the interior, and we see that down through here as well, but also bring air down into the building, light and air, also two elements that Peter was dealing with last week, if you recall. And so here's the central staircase. He's also working with the tile, making the tile lighter as it goes down. Also, again, to kind of lighten up the depth of this so that way he can kind of control the balance of light as it comes in from above. He's also the treatment of the tile itself, the reflective quality, the dimensional depth to it. And so we can see here very, very much so the balance of light coming through the skylight as it works its way down to the darker, lower portions, the amount of light being brightened up. You can see by contrast here down below how dark these stairs are, where the light is flowing in here at the edges. But you can see the effect of how much it illuminates the reflection off of the central corridor here by this technique. This is here down, looking down from above, or from down below looking back up. And in intriguingly enough, when you look down from below, you can see where the color almost kind of balances because of the reflection of the light coming down in. If we go up onto the rooftop, to the attic, this space that he created in addition to what was there prior, we can see the slots in the sides, again, bring light and air into the space. This handling also of a parabolic, soft, ribbed form that we saw in some of his works before the break. He's carrying through the same techniques. This is underneath the back of the dragon that we saw on the exterior. And this is you can see also just the handling of the light coming through, through these ribs, through these, from the side here, as well as the air. And so here, just another, close detail of this detail of where he brings the light in the air. And this is looking up from above on the roof down, through the skylight, where he's also, in addition to that, as you can imagine, as you have these slots, you can see that he's angled these in such a way that the water on the exterior in a rainstorm, for example, would still sheet off and not come into the building. And then also you can see as it comes down and diverts it into a gutter type system that carries it around the skylight here centrally. So he's managing all of these elements of the these natural elements in a very functional way. But still being able to control the interior space in light, air, in temperature, and these types of functional things, but also in addition to the aesthetics. So with that, we're a few minutes over. I'll take any questions if we have any. Well, anything is possible. I don't think that there was any type of connection there, knowing of each other. We're going to see in 2 weeks when we look at Frank Lloyd Wright's Robie House, we'll see how his influence came into Europe by a publication that he put out on the Robey, not only the Robey House, but a few other of his projects. And it's really, if you can imagine, back in the, at the turn of the century, they didn't have the things that we have today, the internet, the telephone, where communication would cross the ocean as easily or as quickly. Word traveled much slower. Even Gaudi in Barcelona, Spain, probably didn't have a whole lot of connection to Germany that we looked at last week. Some of the work that was coming out of Germany at the time, at the same time period. But he did have, Gaudi did have a connection to Le Corbusier late. Le Corbusier came in and visited some of his works, the Sagrada Familia in particular. And so there was some connection or some influence of Gaudi on the modernists that we know of, but not Louis Sullivan. He was a little bit earlier before his time. Good question. Yes. Weathering is always a concern, as we spoke about here just at the tail end of this. The design is done in such a way to try to combat the weather or to hold up to the weather. Despite that, mosaics, the tile itself is very durable, but the grout or the mortar between the tile is susceptible. One of the things that came online during Gaudi's time was Portland cement. And that was a new type of mixture of lime that went into the mix, came out of England. And that was something that was rapidly coming through Spain during Gaudi's period. But as you can imagine, importing the material from England was more costly than getting it locally. And so only the larger commissions could afford such a thing. Gaudi being one of them did specify this English cement, Portland cement, which was much more durable than the other base prior. And so that would help his structures hold up a little bit longer, but nevertheless, it's as anyone that travels there and has visited some of his works, it's in constant kind of repair, is always happening from just age and time. Excellent. Very good. Thank you. So with that, looks like we're over our timeline here. I'll see you next week. We'll pick up with our third house. We'll be back stateside next week out on the West Coast in California. So look forward to that. Thank you.